This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a true crime podcast that topped the charts in Australia and the producer's quest to find the woman at the center of it right here on the Central Coast.
When we got there and we were driving around in this Dodge muscle car, we put some Hawaiian shirts on and listened to some West Coast hip hop. We kind of thought, yeah, we're really detectives here. We're really doing this.
Also, we'll hear about the challenges to San Luis Obispo's economic health.
If one looks at our region, and if one looks at housing projects, those have taken, in some cases, decades. It shouldn't take decades if you know your problem is immediate and people cannot afford housing.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 18th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. A true crime podcast in Australia hit number one on the charts there back in September, and there is a major Central Coast connection. Instead of diving into a murder investigation, as the genre usually focuses on, season four of the Unravel podcast, titled Snowball, zeroes in on what they call love fraud. It revolves around a mysterious woman and the family she allegedly defrauded, and one family member's obsession with finding her that took him all the way across the world, right here to the Central Coast, tracking down another alleged victim in Paso Robles, and even confronting the woman at the center of it all in San Luis Obispo. Here's a quick preview.
My brother married an American con artist.
I find myself in a murky world of con artists and swindlers.
This isn't the kind of story you would expect to happen to a pretty average Kiwi family like mine.
I was just gobsmacked as to what's going on here.
I just remember it being like, whoa.
She had this dark, vivacious...
And then, whoa.
A surfer's skin and look to her.
And then after like two or three woes...
She's a sociopath.
It wasn't really a surprise. You're like, I wonder what the next woe is going to be.
What happened cost us everything.
I held it up to the light and everything merged.
In the end, my parents lost more than $1 million.
We'd been done.
Mum and Dad ended up homeless.
We're destroyed.
I'm going to travel across the world to track Leslie down.
What are we getting ourselves into?
Okay.
I'm running.
Stand by.
I'm Ollie Wards, and I want you to come with me.
The snowball.
For the new season of Unravel.
Is about to hit you.
This time, things really do get personal.
She's walking just in front of you, bro.
Where?
In the middle.
Join me for Snowball.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I see her.
Ollie Wards is a 34-year-old radio producer from New Zealand who works at the Australian broadcasting company called ABC. He's been behind the scenes of their programming for a few years until he got the green light last year to produce his own podcast for their true crime series. It's about his brother's whirlwind marriage to a woman from the United States, her subsequent disappearance, and the family's claim that she defrauded them over $1 million. I recently Skyped with Wards in Australia to learn about the podcast, this mysterious woman, and his trip to the Central Coast.
It all started 10 years ago when my middle brother, so we're a pretty average family from New Zealand, and my brother Greg is obsessed with everything to do with America. He calls himself an Americanophile, and he loves reading all about the news and the politics of the States. And he was a backpacker in London in his mid-20s, and he met an American woman in her late 30s, and he fell in love, was totally obsessed with her crazy stories of running international restaurants and being chased out of Hawaii by murderous local mobsters. And eventually they came back to New Zealand where they got married. But only a few months later, she left. And when he took her to the airport, he thought she was just going on a holiday back to California to visit her family. And the last thing she said to him was, "The snowball is about to hit you." And it ended up with my family losing our home. My parents had sort of unwittingly become the guarantors of a $1.5 million loan for her. And after she left, it turned out that, you know, there's fake documents, alter egos. It's almost kind of like a catch me if you can style story. And that's what I've been investigating over the last year.
And so what year was this when they got married, and then when did she take off for the United States?
Yeah, that was at the end of 2007, and they had obviously met in Europe, but they got married at the end of 2007 and she left in March 2008. So it was only a few months later, and none of us ever saw her again after that.
So you mentioned the $1.5 million. That's Australian dollars. I think that calculates to just a little bit over $1 million in US dollars.
Even less, it was New Zealand dollars. So, and at the time, I mean, the American dollar has been pretty high. So, yeah, would it be about just over two, I reckon.
Well, let's go ahead and break that down. I think people would be interested to know what led your family to loan her this much money and to give her that responsibility of that much money, and then what happened to it.
Yeah, that's right. So she actually got the loan from a New Zealand bank. And to get the loan from the bank, she had to convince them that she had this big American trust fund that she always talked about. She showed them a document, which I've managed to recover, a Bank of America statement showing that she had $5 million in the bank. But that Bank of America statement turned out to be fake. And it's actually quite a bad fake. She makes her fake documents with scissors and glue in a photocopier rather than Photoshop on a computer. So she managed to secure the bank loan, but my parents were unfortunately guarantors for that loan. They never saw her dealings with the bank, so she sort of duped them as well. But they then bought a cafe, a restaurant sort of business, and that's the area that she always said she worked in. She had been sending money back to America, which we were able to find out a little bit later. But before she left, there was things starting to seem strange, but nothing seriously untoward. And it was really after she left that the snowball that she mentioned to my brother really hit and everything was gone.
Now, what did that mean, the snowball is about to hit you?
I think that was her acknowledging that there was a whole lot of, basically a house of cards that she had built that was going to fall down, and it was going to fall down soon. She was probably getting out of the place before that happened, and that's turned out to be the pattern of what she does. The same thing happened in Hawaii. It's happened in Paso Robles after us. So part of the story is me investigating the pattern of this around the world. And unfortunately, if I found a guy in Paso Robles that it happened to after us, and you hear about him in the podcast and how similar the story is.
I mean, was your brother obviously pretty distraught after not hearing his wife leaves and never sees her again?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty tough when your marriage sort of falls apart just a few months after you get married. But for my brother, it sort of took the whole family down with him. And it was devastating. You know, he had to come to terms with somebody that he truly loved leaving and never coming back, but also seeing parents lose the home that we all grew up in together. Everybody started finding out that, you know, she wasn't who she said she was. That, and at that point, everybody kind of brings up things that she had said that didn't add up for them. And people kind of say, oh, I knew something was up, or I knew she wasn't quite who she said she was. So from quite a few angles, he was feeling pretty devastated over that time where the family crumbled a little bit, his relationship did, and it was all because he had fallen in love with somebody who is basically a known con artist.
So you just mentioned people looking back and saying, you know, that didn't seem right. Was there anything that happened at the time when they were together that just didn't feel right to you, your family, or him?
Yeah, so I was living overseas most of the time. So I met her briefly when they were together in the UK, and then I flew back to New Zealand to MC the wedding. And there were quite a few things that she would tell you about. I mentioned before she had the story about being run out of Hawaii by the mafia who were trying to kill her because she had got engaged with them in some sort of business deal at her bar there. And I was going, oh, yeah, okay. It seems pretty full on. But, you know, the way she would tell it, she would be really dogged in the way that she would give you all the details. So it seemed to add up. But then the next time she would tell it, it would be slightly different. But in New Zealand, people are quite I guess there's a certain humility and an understatement, and people don't usually kind of big note themselves. And when people do that, everyone else gets a little bit shy about it. So I think there was a cultural difference there that allowed her to, she was this Californian power business lady coming in, shaking things up. And, you know, here are all these sort of Kiwis from New Zealand who didn't really know what to say. So we all just let her go around telling all these stories. And, you know, there was other ones like she hung out with rock stars and all these famous people in America. But when it came time for them to get married and for this huge wedding that we had, only two people from her side came, her parents. She had all these trust fund friends, all these rock star friends. And then out of about 150 guests, the only two that came from her side were her parents. So there were alarm bells and everyone thought it was weird, but we just sort of went, oh, okay, and moved on.
Now, didn't you mention that some people almost thought that they were paid actors?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of guests at the wedding seemed to think that the parents didn't really act like her parents. And there's a really strange relationship there. So her story is that she was a baby in Armenia and was smuggled out as a refugee baby. But her biological parents left a massive trust fund for her, this millions of dollars that she claimed, and that she was adopted by this family in Buena Park in California. And that seemed to be quite a strange backstory. And then when her parents turned up, they were very quiet, didn't say much. Her mum, I said, she had almost permanently pursed lips. And her dad had this sort of squint through glasses that was somehow at the same time suspicious and disinterested. And they just sort of stood around and everyone was like, okay, this is weird. We thought that the dad was supposedly rich from selling tanks to the US Army. But it turned out that he was in fact selling water tanks to the Army. So when somebody tells you they're selling tanks to the Army, you don't think water tanks. But so all of this stuff was kind of out there, but it's really hard to draw a dotted line between one or two strange things to something broader. And when you've got a family member, when you've got a brother, a son, or a friend who seems really happy and seems in love, it's whose place is it to kind of start calling out these strange things and take them aside and say, I don't think this adds up.
Well, obviously things did not end well in this relationship and she was not heard from again. And did people in your family try to reach out and contact her and it just with no success for a long period of time?
No, there was some contact when she got back to the States. There were letters exchanged. There were a few phone calls. My dad hired a private investigator to help at one point and they tracked her down. And the New Zealand police were involved, but there's a jurisdiction thing here as well where they basically said she's left the country and there's a border alert in place for her if she ever came back to the country, but they're not able to come and get her in California, which does seem to be something that she's worked to her advantage. And in my investigation, I've been dealing with the US justice system and the various actions that have been taken against her, even within California, different counties. And then some of the stuff she's done in Hawaii and then in the UK as well. When you're swapping borders and jurisdictions, it's quite hard for white collar crimes to catch up with you.
Wow. So about a decade goes by between when she leaves and then you decide to pick this up as a podcast. Can you break down what happened with your brother and you and your family during this time?
Initially, what happened is my family had to kind of pull together to try and save the business that she had bought. But unfortunately, the bank foreclosed on that. And it was the very same bank that had accepted all the fake documents and like bad fake documents as her credentials. She has a lawyer who acts on her behalf. And this is a real kicker. When my dad became quite obsessed with investigating everything and trying to understand what happened, he managed to gain access to her emails. And so for about a year and a half, my dad was logging in and basically copy pasting her emails and being able to see what she was doing. And it turns out that there's almost like a fight club kind of situation between her name's Leslie and this lawyer called Eric, who it seems is actually her. So she creates and plays the role of this sort of fake lawyer who was liaising with the bank in New Zealand. I've got the letters that he wrote to the bank. I've got emails that he even sends to her. So it becomes this kind of psychological hall of mirrors where trying to unpick whether this guy's real or not, or whether it's just her other personality. is really what we started investigating. My dad became obsessed with it, and that's what I've been looking into all these years later.
Tell me about the move to turn this into a podcast and start documenting and recording all this.
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange thing. I sort of said to somebody that it's almost like taking your family's dirty laundry, hanging it on the washing line, and inviting the neighborhood around to have a look at it, because it's definitely a really personal story. And working at a radio station myself, I'm often helping other people tell stories, and I started thinking about this one, thinking, yeah, hang on. And I didn't know a lot about it, so I went home to New Zealand from Australia, and when I got there, I started asking my dad about it, and I had a microphone with me, and the more he started telling me, the more I was facepalming, going, this is a bit crazy. So I turned the microphone on, and that's when I realized I had something here, and I pitched the story to the ABC, which, like I said, is the NPR equivalent in Australia. They loved it, and here I am, having just released it. It's the latest season of their true crime series called Unravel.
I was wondering, with such a crazy story, why this wasn't the first one. So you just approached them after a couple of seasons and said, hey, by the way, I have this crazy story we should dive into.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, podcasts and the true crime kind of genre have become really big over the last few years. The first three seasons of Unravel are about unsolved murders. And, you know, I'm sure you've listened to podcasts. Serial, obviously the one that kind of blew this genre up, where there's a real sense of blood and guts and gore and kind of unsolved murders. And they tend to be tragically of poor, innocent young women. But this story kind of follows on from, I guess, what Dirty John started, the LA Times Wondery story of more white collar kind of con artistry and narcissists and sociopaths convincing people of somebody that they're not. So I think this story actually represents a bit of a change in the trend of true crime podcasts to look at more love fraud and the sort of more nuanced crime that's less blood and guts than the unsolved murders. And there's a lot in my story that's actually just genuinely funny. It's almost like a comedy true crime, because some of her, like I said, her fake documents are so bad that you wonder how professionals at a bank would let them go past. Like I said, this you know, this kind of fake lawyer that she has is quite entertaining. A lot of it's actually just genuinely funny. So it's season four, because it's maybe representing a different direction, and there's a different host and journalist for each of the seasons.
So as part of the podcast, you come to the United States and you come to the central coast of California, where we are. Tell us about getting here and your arrival and your experiences while you were here, first impressions.
Yeah, so I had to tap in my oldest brother, not the one that was married to Leslie, but my oldest brother is a bit of a security guard, I guess. But we landed in LA, and, you know, it was bright and sunny, and there was lots of palm trees like we expected. He wasn't stoked that I had hired the hatchback economy rental car, so he insisted on a muscle car upgrade. And we ended up, you know, there's a lot of iconography that we have about America and about California that is, being from the other side of the world, we still watch all the movies, we still watch all the TV shows. And when we got there and we were driving around in this Dodge muscle car, we put some Hawaiian shirts on and listened to some West Coast hip-hop, we kind of thought, yeah, we're really detectives here. We're really doing this. And we were quite pumped up, and a lot of it felt like we were in a movie. And then as we made our way into places in California that I'd never heard of, like San Luis Obispo or Paso Robles, we started to meet more and more people that had encountered this person and that had been conned, lied to, you know, convinced of a reality that wasn't the case. And it started getting quite dark, and we ended up, one of the places we went was in Paso Robles. There's literally a saloon from the Wild West where Jesse James the gunslinger had hung out in it, and we had to go in there and interview people, and it felt quite gangster, and we were pretty nervous. You know, there's a, like I said, we know a lot about America, and a lot of it is kind of scary. So it was a couple of Kiwi boys in the big pond trying to swim.
Well, what did you end up finding out about Leslie while you were in the Central Coast here in Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo?
Yeah, so we found a gentleman who we call Cameron in the podcast, who had amazingly similar story to my brother, almost a mirror image. And unfortunately, it was after she had left New Zealand, and she rolled out the same playbook and convinced this guy to invest a lot of his money into a restaurant that she would run. She was allegedly sort of embezzling money out of it, writing checks in his name and cashing them. And eventually, when it was discovered, she left Paso Robles with a bit of a trail of destruction behind her. And then I was following, every time I'd meet somebody, they would say, oh, you should go and speak to this other person. And then that person would give me another clue. And it led me to find out that she works in a supermarket there in San Luis Obispo. So we had to basically do a stakeout of the supermarket. We parked in our muscle car in the car park and watched as people came and went, because we were worried that as soon as she knew we were there, she would either go to ground or she would potentially have somebody that would, you know, be some muscle over us. Eventually, I did spot her and I just approached her. I had a microphone. There was a guy filming and I had a chat to her, and I expected her to drive away because I got to her just as her car door was closing. And I said, hey, Leslie, it's Ollie. And she said, hello. And we talked for about half an hour in that car park of the supermarket in San Luis Obispo. And she's very convincing. She's very good at this kind of stuff. And you hear this in the podcast where I'm putting all these accusations to her, and she most of the time she has an answer, but you end up coming away from it realizing that this is somebody who can lie very well.
This video, which is on your website, is a little tough to watch because you can tell that there's a suspense in trying to get her, and then you do get her in her car, and you can tell that, you know, she doesn't want to talk to you, but then she also opens up a little bit, and then you can get the sense that you want to get the conversation now or you may never get her again. So it is a tough watch. What did you learn from this interaction?
I learned that confidence is everything. And I actually didn't know that con artist, that's what it means, confidence artist. And it's all about presenting yourself as, no, there's no problem here. And as long as you have a story and stick to it, that can actually be all you need. As implausible as the story might be, if you seem confident about it, that can build trust in the people you're talking to. So I had been looking at these fake documents and police reports and court records for literally months. And then when I was there face to face with her and she was smiling and saying, no, there must be a mistake, it was almost like a Jedi mind trick where I was kind of going, oh, maybe there is no mistake. There is a mistake here. That's one thing I learned, is that people who are able to lie that well, I think maybe even lie to themselves and convince themselves so well that they can overcome any facts that are put in front of them. I mean, I did show her some documents at the time and she kind of said, oh, no, I don't know what to tell you about those. But I also learned that empathy for other people is not universal. That you often think that everybody has the ability to feel sorry if they've hurt somebody, to understand that their actions might have affected somebody else. But with this person, and I guess it's the definition of a sociopath and a psychopath, is they don't feel empathy, and they can academically understand it and they can use that against other people. But in some circumstances, people don't really care if they've hurt anybody.
Interesting. So did you talk to the local authorities while you were here? Were you able to talk to the police, let them know what was going on? And if so, what did they say?
Yeah, so I've reached out to various arms of the American justice system, and I would underline various arms because it's just amazing how there's county police, state police, various other law enforcement. I wrote to the FBI. The list goes on. And essentially, the evidence that we have from New Zealand was investigated by the New Zealand police, but it wasn't enough for them to transfer a file without speaking to her to the American police. So without that, I didn't have anything new to present them. But what I did discover is that she had various actions against her in Hawaii, and I got in touch with the Hawaiian police, who sort of had some sort of bureaucratic stuff up, where I talked to the chief of the Maui police and I presented him with the police reports from the time. And then I spoke to the Hawaiian prosecutor's office, who said they never got those reports from the police. And the chief of the Maui County police said to me, oh, I don't know what happened. I think his words were, these got lost in the shuffle. So she was able to just get away from Hawaii. And in California, the gentleman who she conned in Paso Robles didn't actually go to the police, and he didn't want to drag himself back through it. He said that when this kind of thing happens to you, you sometimes just want to pick up your life and move on. And that's actually something I learned from this investigation and speaking to experts, is that a lot of victims of love fraud and con artists actually don't go to law enforcement because they feel humiliated. A lot of it, the writing was on the wall. They might have even had friends and family telling them that this was going to happen, so they feel embarrassed. And of course, when things go to the police, it becomes public knowledge, so they often just don't tell the police. And without him as the witness, I couldn't go forward with the law enforcement in the States.
And for anyone listening that isn't familiar, New Zealand is a much smaller country than the United States. What were some big takeaways from the difference between your police system and our police system?
Well, the big takeaway is that there's only one. the New Zealand police are very active. They're a highly professional force. I think the chief of the fraud group that I interviewed for the podcast and was looking at the file at the time said that to commence proceedings internationally and to the United States is a massive expense. It's very difficult to do, and it was essentially something that the bar was too high to get over, and therefore once she had left New Zealand, she would just get away, basically. They placed a border alert in case she ever comes back. But what I learned about the American justice system is that the jurisdictions are so different between one another that it can be really hard to actually link up. For example, the counties, some of them have online searches for records, some of them don't. I recovered a document that she had given to somebody, which was a City of Buena Park criminal history check, but it was only for the city. What's the point of having a criminal history check from the boundaries of a city? I learned that there's a lot of enforcement agencies, a lot of jurisdictions, and a lot of opportunities for criminals who understand that to actually bounce around between them and get away, basically.
Without giving away too much of your podcast, which you obviously want people to listen to, what would you like people out here to know here on the Central Coast? Is there any reason to be concerned that there is a frauder in our midst, or possibly?
I learned how common this stuff is, and there's obviously different scales. I mean, there's, you know, the Catch Me If You Can movie, which this reminded me of a lot, right down to people who just add a bit of mayonnaise onto their stories to make themselves sound a bit better. And I think being aware of that there are people that are willing to lie to loved ones out there is a good thing to be aware of. And their nefarious reasons for doing it might range from just wanting to big note themselves up to actually stealing your money. And I think look out for inconsistencies in people's backstories. If people show large, grandiose scales of affection and give gifts that seem beyond the relationship, that's a warning sign. If people don't want you to meet their family and friends, that's often a warning sign. And one thing that might trouble you is that California, Hawaii, New Zealand, places that are beautiful, places that have a tropical setting, for some reason tend to attract these people, because often the populations are transient. She was in Tahoe as well. The populations are transient. People make connections really fast because of tourism industries and that kind of thing. They are rife with con artists and people who are out to scam you.
Wow, this has been wildly fascinating. So what's next for you and your family now that this season of this podcast is wrapped?
Well, there's a really funny thread throughout this podcast that when my dad was investigating it, he became obsessed with Dr. Phil. Because Dr. Phil airs on daytime New Zealand TV every day. I'm sure it does in the States.
That's right. You reached out to him to try to get him to look into this, correct?
Dad wrote him a pitch which he had put in Comic Sans font. So it wasn't the most professional thing. But Dad still brings up, and you hear it in the podcast, where I'm investigating this story for Australia's national broadcaster. And Dad keeps saying, but, you know, do you think it could be time to approach Dr. Phil again? And I'm just like, Dad, I'm investigating this. But so I think it would be a natural climax to the story and to end on our family and possibly Leslie, the con artist, being on Dr. Phil. So I hope that one day that happens. And who knows? There's a few kind of Netflix-y type people buzzing around. So maybe we'll get this thing on the screens at some point.
Well, Ollie, go ahead and tell people where they can find your podcast and give them all the information about it if they want to go ahead and download this and listen to it.
So it's the latest season of Unravel True Crime, and it's called Snowball. So if you just search on Apple Podcasts or Google or whatever you use, if you just search Unravel Snowball or just Snowball, you'll be able to find it. And I don't want to say I borrowed too heavily, but the artwork is influenced by the old Catch Me If You Can artwork. It's a picture of me with a microphone chasing Leslie across a globe. Really hope that you can have a listen to it. It's a very much an American story as much as it is a New Zealand story.
That's Ollie Ward, the producer of that podcast, via Skype from Australia. KCPX News tried to track down the woman at the center of the podcast to get her viewpoint of the story. But despite several attempts to reach her by phone, we got her voicemail, but no return calls. We were also able to confirm that until recently, she did work at a San Luis Obispo grocery store, but she no longer works there. Ward's mentioned in our interview that other parties have been interested in telling his family's story, saying that both Dr. Phil and Dateline have expressed interest. He's also currently working on a follow-up episode. So this may not be the last we hear of this mysterious woman who may or may not still be living here on the Central Coast. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Next, we speak with the head of San Luis Obispo's Economic Vitality Corporation, or EVC, about the county's economic forecast and the biggest challenges faced by those doing business or looking to do business on the Central Coast. KCPX's Greta Mart has this interview.
We're here in the KCPX studio, and may I ask you to introduce yourself?
Michael Manchak, the president and CEO of the Economic Vitality Corporation, a nonprofit organization throughout San Luis Obispo County.
Tell me what took place.
It's an annual economic forecast that happens and produced by the Central Coast Economic Forecast, an organization that's local. I happen to serve on that organization. And it provides really a look to the future. So what will 2020, in this case, look like economically? So let's start with the presentation that was made in San Luis Obispo by Beacon Economics. Chris Thornburg, an economist that does forecasts throughout the nation, made a very interesting presentation, as he normally does. The information he provided was first on a national and a statewide level, and then he drilled down into the economic forecast for next year on the local level. On the national level, as we all know, the economy is very strong, but the economy, both state and nationally, have issues, and we can talk about that, as does the local economy. The local economy is very strong. On almost every metric that's measured. That said, there's some issues that are systemic in our community. And Chris really hit right on the head those issues that are really, as he points out, that are stunting the natural growth of the economy. So all economies have to grow a little bit. That's just the nature of economies. Even a couple percent is actually not a bad thing. Once you get much below that, it becomes very concerning. Here locally, we actually have an almost zero population growth in this county. And in fact, there are some communities pointed out in the presentation that are actually shrinking. And they're shrinking primarily by two things. One, which is the cost of housing, and also a lack of good paying jobs. So with those two things, unfortunately, our county is viewed as one of the sixth or seventh least affordable places in the nation to live. And that's a bad thing. That's a very concerning thing. And that's not something that's been changing in a positive direction.
I see. So young people are leaving because they can't buy a house, and there's not good paying jobs here, or not a plethora of them.
Exactly. Exactly, Greta. And moreover, the jobs that are here pay less than they do in other places. So it is really a double whammy. It's very high cost of not just buying homes, but renting a home or an apartment is more here than a lot of other places. That said, if you look to the Bay Area, homes there and rentals are, of course, more expensive. But the difference is, of course, is that the incomes are much, much higher there. So there is less of an imbalance there of affordability than there is here. Here, it's really challenging in that regard. It's very hard to attract talent. In the time I've had this position, for many years, it's it the number one challenge of virtually every business is attracting talent. And even the businesses that we get calls from other places that are looking to move to the area, they don't ask about the cost of housing. They don't ask about crime or schools or anything else, for which I'm sure they're interested in. The real first big question they ask is, what's the workforce look like? So workforce development, and that's what that's called. How do you have enough workers to do the work, regardless of the type of job? And that's something that's a real struggle here. And the affordability of the area is causing that to be worse.
So when you do the forecast, do you get into any kind of solutions? Or is it just, it's laying out, this is the scenario that we're facing?
Yeah, and let me back up if I could. So the EVC that I represent, albeit I serve on the board of the Central Coast Economic Forecast, the EVC does economic development throughout the county. Though the forecast was done for the Central Coast Economic Forecast by Beacon Economics. So it's strictly different, but clearly we're really interested in what Chris has to say. As to your point and question about solutions, he did. Chris had some very pointed solutions about what is the largest problem in our community, which is, he kept pointing to it again and again in the presentation, which was housing. There is an unwillingness to create enough housing for everyone so that the price of either rentals and so forth is at par with income, if you will. So there's that good balance. We don't have that good balance. Rentals are very hard to find throughout the county, and they're very expensive, and they're more expensive than a lot of places. And what Chris Thornburg of Beacon Economics points out is that that's not a good long-term picture. That's a very dangerous picture for the balance of an economy. So the affordability issue that Chris points out is really something that is a long-term concern for the community, for economists like himself, and for even the EVC as an economic development organization. We have, imbalance. We have companies that come into the community, and the community, I mean the county, and then there are some that leave the community. In order to have a good balance of jobs, you have to have enough jobs that are here and good paying jobs in order to have a vibrant and balanced and even diverse community.
So earlier this week, the County Board of Supervisors, they also heard kind of a five-year forecast. Guy Savage crunched some numbers and gave a forecast about, the next 5 years. And what wasn't mentioned at all in that conversation was the closing of Diablo Canyon. So did Chris get into that at all? Is that factor into the economic forecast?
That's a great question. Chris didn't. He mentioned it very briefly that he knew that was a concern in our community. With Diablo Canyon, and since it was announced it would be closed, and it's going to close in just a few years, so in about 5 years actually, the impact by virtue of the Cal Poly study of the plant was of an economic impact of about $900 million a year, almost $1 billion if you rounded it up. By virtue of a bill that was that implemented by Senator Monning, UC Berkeley actually ran the numbers, and they came up with a number that was a fraction of that. So their number came up with $77 million, not $890 million. So there's a big issue there. It is an issue, but it's not the issue in the view of a lot of people. And when I say a lot of people, I mean a lot of business people in various sectors. They're more concerned, many of these people are more concerned about housing, about the ability to have facilities for their companies to grow and therefore provide jobs. And then ultimately attracting talent.
Okay, got it. So let's move on. What are some other points that he made?
Chris Thornburg pointed out also that the political dysfunction in the nation, the partisanship, is really not helping business look to invest more and hire more. As he pointed out, there back in the day, there were more politicians that would disagree about the solution, but not the problem. But now politicians seem to be disagreeing on both what the problem is and what the solution could be. There's that. Chris also mentioned that, albeit the, the national and state and local economies are strong if you look at all the numbers, whether it's employment rate, whether it's the tax revenues, et cetera. He also did point out that the job market is so tight that's constraining the economy. But he said there is a direct correlation between the economy's constraint, meaning how do you naturally grow the economy to be healthy, and again, housing. So he drew it back to housing time and time again during the presentation. And remember, this is someone who makes this presentation throughout the nation. In fact, he does it internationally now. So he really does know what he's talking about. He's been doing this for the better part of a decade in our county. So he knows the county very well. But he's, again, concerned about the population growth, which is near zero in our county, the fact that young people are leaving because of the lack of affordability and the lack of good-paying jobs. And then he's ultimately concerned about, you know, how do you attract business? And again, this is his chicken or egg issue. How do you attract business to provide those jobs if there isn't the infrastructure like housing there?
Okay, got it. Earlier you said that there's a kind of an unwillingness, you mean on the part of like county officials or policy for building more housing?
Well, so Chris talked about not the national issue of housing. It's really a state issue and as well as a local issue. Just yesterday I was at the California Economic Summit, and that's a annual event that happens really focused on issues that are about the state's economy and policy. It wasn't a forecast like this was here. But the issue there is about water, it's about jobs, and about housing. Three things. There, much like here, the issue is, again, about infrastructure. So if you go back to your question, which I think is a really important one about willingness, Chris Thornburg, it's his professional opinion that there's a lack of willingness to create enough housing that is needed. In fact, he put the numbers on the board, and it showed that there is a mere fraction of what is necessary is being developed. If one looks at our region, just our region alone, and if one looks at housing projects, those have taken, in some cases, decades. And I guess that's what Chris is trying to point out, which is it shouldn't take decades if you know your problem is immediate and people cannot afford housing. And he does point out to other areas that also have, you know, what some people call NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. But he said, you know, even in Texas, he said there's a lot of NIMBYism that happens there. That said, he says their economy is growing in a healthy pace, and they're creating jobs and attracting 150,000 people a year to Texas alone just because of that, because young people can afford to live there. And again, these are people even who are professionals, who some of the highest paying paid graduates out of Cal Poly, let's say in, for example, the computer engineering or computer science fields, they're being paid a lot of money, but they'll go to the Bay Area and their money doesn't go that far. They stay here and there's not as many jobs. So what they are often doing is they're jumping out of the state and they're going to places like Colorado and Texas and so forth, where there's a very healthy and strong job market and good wages, but also plenty of housing that's affordable.
I remember recently I did an interesting piece where I talked to somebody who said that even if the county were to green light tons of new housing, there's no one available to build the housing. That in the construction industry, there just aren't as many construction workers as is needed to actually build the housing. So what do you think of that idea?
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
There's always people that could come into the market that are construction experts or construction workers to build those.
Okay.
And I think I would push back on that theory because clearly building is happening in a lot of places. So clearly there are enough people to build the homes. The question is not the ability to build the homes. The question is just the willingness. That's really what it comes down to. And that's what Chris has said time and time again. And, you know, frankly, I mean, there are people who disagree with Chris Thornburg at Beacon Economics. However, I would submit that most people find that he's usually not wrong. They can agree with him, disagree with him philosophically, but in terms of the data, it is what it is. In terms of examples used elsewhere, they are what they are. So I would say that there's lots of excuses that people can use as to why something doesn't happen, but the reality is that if we really wanted it to happen here, we would. And we'd happen faster. And the problem with it not happening fast enough is that when it does come online, there's such a pent-up demand that the price goes up so much that it defeats the purpose, which is now what we're supposed to be workforce housing is now very expensive. And that is really a challenge. The other issue too, Greta, is that in the county, we have another issue of the affordability factor, which is median income. The median income in the county of San Luis Obispo is below the state and national average. That is not the case in Santa Barbara County. That is not the case in Monterey County. We are a bit of an outlier in that regard, and it's a concern. I know that there's often the comment that's been made for people that have lived here a long time, which is that you just get paid less here. That's a real challenge when businesses are looking to attract talent. Now, they're often not looking to attract necessarily immediate college graduates. They're looking for people with more experience. So as they call it, middle management. They're looking for people with enough experience that can help grow a company. If you can grow a company and it can thrive, you create really good paying jobs and you can afford to live here. If you can't, you have what we have, which is that you've got people leaving.
That was Michael Manchak, CEO of the Economic Vitality Corporation, talking about a recent economic forecast presented for San Luis Obispo County. We'll post more of the interview later at kcbx.org. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. A San Luis Obispo dance company recently debuted its fall season of performances. Movement Arts Collective's mission is to enhance the artistic landscape of the local and regional community through dance performance, education, and outreach, building both the artist and the audiences of the future. Building both the artists and the audiences of the future. Their contemporary and modern dance performance, Ballet Unbound, premiered over the weekend. In case you missed it, they'll have performances coming up in February in collaboration with Festival Mosaic. I recently sat down with the collective's founders to talk about their international careers, what brought them to the Central Coast, and the inspiration behind their work. You can catch their full interview at kcbx.org.
I'm Marcia Lawrence. I am the director of the Movement Arts Center, and I also am a artistic director of the Movement Arts Collective, which is here in SLO. I moved from the Netherlands, so you'll hear an accent. I'll do my very best. I moved about 8 years ago, and with our three children, I danced professionally as a ballerina in Europe. That's also how I met my husband, and he's from this town. And that's how I ended up here in SLO, and I'm very excited to be here.
My name is Ryan Lawrence. I grew up here in San Luis Obispo before pursuing dance on a professional stages, really around the world and the country. As Marcia mentioned, we met in the Netherlands at a company there called Scapino Ballet Rotterdam, and we moved back to the Central Coast, I think it was about 8 years ago.
What drew you both back to the Central Coast?
Well, having grown up here, it was a fantastic place to be a kid. We also have I have family here. My family, my brother, my sister, and my parents still live here. So when we had kids of our own, my thought was where better to raise them than here. I don't know if Marcia knew what she was getting into with that. Neither one of us knew what we were getting into when we decided to marry each other. No one
Not
warned
really.
Us. This is what happens when you marry someone that is from a different country. But we've made it home here over the last 8 years.
Okay, well, great. So tell me about the Movement Arts Collective.
Well, it kind of started because we were longing for something that I left. I was in a very cultural city, lots of art, different art forms come together, and we wanted to keep that going. And I think the Movement Arts Collective is one of those ways for us to put our creativity to use and inspire people and work with dancers in more ways than just training them to be good technicians, which we do at the school. Here we're asking a little bit more from them as a human being, as a person, and putting something on stage that people take home. So I think for me, the Movement Arts Collective is that little extra artistic abundance. I don't know how you would say that, but Maybe I used the wrong words, but that's how I would explain it.
Marshall, in your experience with growing up overseas, is there any difference in growing up with dance over there compared to over here, or is it universal in its language?
Are you sure you want me to answer this? Yes, it's different. Dance is universal. Dance is literally moving and expressing yourself through your body. So that's everywhere and everything. And I think it comes even before any religion or anything that the human race we have done ever. Movement is what we could do first. That's the first thing we do when we take our first breath, right? So dance is everywhere for me. But it's really cool to see how the cultures give it a different language to dance. So where I'm from, it's very much about what do you experience watching a dance? Like, we have a lot of modern dance where you sometimes leave the theater and you're like, whoa, what did I just see? What is this? Whoa, you really have to think a minute. And then you realize, wow, I was part of something bigger than just me. And that's something I sometimes miss a little bit here in the States, where I feel like a lot of performances still are very much around entertainment and making it just a very fun, let's go to the theater and clap, and, you know, which is wonderful, and I love that. But I miss sometimes a little bit that depth. But it doesn't mean it's not there. It is here. I feel like, especially St. Louis right now, is opening up to that. I see it in the museums. I see it in the theater programs. Things are growing. Things are bubbling. And I'm super excited that we, as the dance part, can be part of that a little bit.
So yeah. Having been dancers, choreographers, and now in the artistic roles and executive director roles of an arts organization, I think we're gaining a more of an appreciation for how all the parts work together. So how the audience contributes to a show, how the dancers contribute, how the choreographer contributes, and that it is really an experience that we're trying to provide, and an experience that's lasting. Something that, you know, the only thing I want is to people to have a reaction to the show, not to be able to come to the show and 2 minutes later be talking about, okay, what's next? What are we on to? But to have something that lingers, to give something that will create a conversation afterwards over a meal or drinks with friends, that children will appreciate it, and it'll spark things in a conversation with their family that parents or other audience members just might have that opportunity to either feel something within themselves or create a conversation about art, about our culture, about where we are, about how we interact with one another, about our existence.
Well, let's jump into that. You've got two shows coming up on the 15th and 17th, Ballet Unbound, and the theme is overcoming barriers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so go ahead and talk to me about this show. There's three parts of it.
It is a mixed bill, and in that we're trying to provide an opportunity for ballet, which is a historic art form, 400 years old, but what is it today? And so in that, we're kind of giving context with the first piece is Harlequinade. It was originally choreographed by Marius Petipa for the Russian, the Tsars in St. Petersburg, and it's being restaged by Catherine Barnacle here. It being ballet, the barriers are pretty shallow, and it's basically financial barriers to falling in love. So simple story, boy likes a girl, boy is a funny guy. In Venice, in carnival time, the characters come from Commedia dell'arte. Boy likes a girl, Harlequin, likes Columbine. Columbine's dad doesn't think Harlequin is serious enough. He doesn't have the money, doesn't want them to get married. So their barrier is simple. They just want to fall in love and follow each other and live their life. It's a great showcase of the technicality of ballet, the theatricality of ballet, how we use ballet to tell a story. Next on the piece on the program is March's piece, and it's a world premiere called Uprooted, and I'll let her talk a little bit about that because it's a really special contribution to the program.
So my piece is actually about my experience of immigrating here. So I actually met with several people to collaborate. I'm working with Logan Castro, who's a musician and a composer, and he makes the most incredible music. And when I hear his music, I get pulled into a story right away. I have dreams. I see things happening in front of my eyes. And then the project starts. Then I talk with another friend who emigrated just like I did and wrote a thesis about it for her psychology study. And we came to a very similar space where when you feel uprooted, literally pulled out of your roots, out of your home, where everything, like even from where your coffee cup is standing every morning, is always the same spot. All of a sudden, everything's different, and you have to re-find yourself within a different place. It's pretty stressful. And how you, by embracing the new and comforting the memories, can find an in-between place. And that's really what my piece is about helping people, whichever it could be, a relationship problem. It could be for everyone something different. For me, it was an immigration, where there is a space where I can cherish the old and receive the new, which is for me America, and find a safe place in the middle of that where I feel myself. And that took me 8 years to get to that place. And that's kind of what my piece is about.
Wow. And considering the intense national discussion we're having about immigration right now, did that play a role there towards the end as things have really ramped up over the past few years?
It's kind of interesting. At first, I was not, like, it really came from within myself. So I really just made it. And then Ryan, actually, that's luckily I have him. He went, well, you know, this could cause some controversy, or you know what it could look like from the outside. We have to be aware of it. And then I thought about it, and I realized that yes, that's possible, but that's okay for me, because it is an issue, and it is everywhere, and it is important that we don't shove it under the table. So I'm good with that.
Marcia and Ryan Lawrence, thank you so much for stopping by. This has been an enlightening conversation, and best of luck.
Great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.